I have two questions. The first is, you are busting union myths all over the place over here. So in the spirit of that, can you tell us some of the benefits of being in a union besides birthday calls and a pension plan? Because I bet there's more that a whole bunch of us don't know. And then I'll get
Well,
to the second question after.
well, I always say that joining Local 1000 gives you two different kinds of benefits. There's heart benefits,
Oh.
and the heart benefits are the birthday calls, the satisfaction of knowing that your union is thinking of you. And you also get access to this network of amazing, amazing musicians. I mean, we some of I mean, John McCutcheon is one of our founders, and is amazing. He's become a dear friend over the years because we've worked together in Local 1000. And there's people that you can talk to in Local 1000 who can give you advice, who've been doing this forever. A lot of times I will go to John and say, I need help with this. I need to talk about this, but I need some help with talking points. Can you help me out? And you go, oh yeah. And my dear friend Joe Jenks, who's also a wonderful songwriter,
I
Janice
love
E Janice Ian is one of our members.
Okay, cool.
Just it's just you know just this you're being in this organization with some amazing people who do a lot of really, really good work. And so that's heart benefits. Oh, and when we get together, we sing. We just sing. You know, this is
Right.
we start every meeting with a song. We end every meeting with a song. It's just the way it goes around here. But then there's the hand benefits, the benefits you can put your hand on, like the pension plan, instrument insurance. Instrument insurance is
Ooh.
amazing. It's really the best deal around. The recording contracts. I did my last record under a union contract, and one of the benefits of that is when you do a recording under a union contract, every August you get money.
Why every August?
Because that's when they do the payments, the payouts. It's called the
Oh,
Special Recordings Fund.
wow.
And yesterday I got a check for a very nice, I mean, a hell of a lot more than Spotify. You know,
That's good.
I got a very nice hefty check from the Special Payments Fund because I did my recording Green in the Dark on a union contract.
Wow. Huh.
So those
So
are.
who is the contract? Is it with the recording studio? Is it with the distributor of the music?
No, the recording, the contract is done with the union.
Okay, so like the union is contracting you to
No,
record? Yeah,
no. What
explain
I,
more.
it's basically what it says is that my recording was done in which I paid everybody on that recording that had anything to do with that recording union scale wages. They
We're just
also
wondering
got.
who the other party on the contract is. Because that way, if anybody is looking at becoming a member of AFM 1000, hi, hello, you rang, there is some understanding of what that particular benefit amounts to.
Every contract has an employer-employee relationship, right?
Right.
So, and this is where it gets a little in the weeds. So, I had a friend of mine who has a collective bargaining agreement with Local 1000. He has his own company. He has an LLC, a limited liability corporation, and he acted as the employer. His corporation acted as the employer because his corporation has, see, and this is where we're getting a little bit complicated. He is a signatory to the sound recordings department of the AFM.
Okay, gotcha.
So, yeah. So, by using him and his corporation as the employer, we were able, we used what's called a low budget scale contract. And I did Greening the Dark with a union contract. And what that says is every musician was paid scale wages, fairly fair wages, which we did anyway. I do that with all my recordings. All of my musicians get paid at least scale wages. Each Yay. Musician got a contribution to the pension fund in their name. And in the case, I had one non-union musician, and they're not participating in the pension fund, but there was a pension payment made on their behalf. Nice. And Local 1000 received work dues for all of that work. I was so proud to say on that recording, this is a union recording. There's a little symbol called the union bug, and it's on anything that's printed by a union shop.
Mm.
And that says to the world that all the workers who helped create this thing were treated fairly and paid a living wage and have benefits.
It's like the sign for the for when something is fair trade certified or certified organic, except
right.
for music right. and work.
Right, right, right.
I love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for explaining it. That really helps.
Yeah. So that's why I'm passionate about Local 1000, because I'm also passionate about working people. I come from working people, and my great grandparents were working people. And unions, I mean, it's because of unions that we don't have child labor, and we have weekends, and we have the 40-hour work week. And I will also say that I am not one of these my union right or wrong people. Yes, some unions have done some really pretty awful things.
Mm.
And when I see a union who is not advocating in the best interests of their members or other people, I will call it out. So there you go.
Thank you for that. My mind is going to all of this stuff about like the details of how one gets paid for their recordings and all of that. But really, let's skip all that. Like, I'm like, what about like the percentage of royalties from those Spotify streams? And isn't it too small to even matter? But no, let's not go there. I just want to talk about recording in general and take us back to like the music. Do you have cool stories to share with us about recording songs and like the musical part of it and people you've collaborated with?
And how was the recording in the studio experience different than either of you expected? Because Heather, you have also, and so have I guess, technically. Yes, we have all recorded in studios at this point. So let's also talk about how that was different than we thought.
Well, my very first, besides that awful demo that I was a part of.
Yes, tell us positive experiences.
Well, I am the kind of person that craves feedback. And a lot of that is probably just because my dreadful insecurity problem. I don't know. But
we were just talking yesterday in another interview about how feedback is so important to what we do as creatives who are also, business owners. Like, it's really vital that we're not just creating in a void. So you're among friends there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It was like when I was telling you about my earlier experience about asking for feedback, and don't be nice to me. I need to hear the bad stuff. I need to hear what I need to work on, because that's how we improve as creatives. If you're in your own little bubble thinking you're perfect, you're never going to get better. And you're never going to learn. Learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I have learned so much since I made my very first solo recording. My first solo recording was done 20 years ago, or released 20 years ago. And before that, I had been in the studio 3 times. Not excluding that horrible demo.
Three and a half times.
Yeah. And each time it was, I mean, the first time when I did a real album, and this was before anybody could afford to do CDs, I was with a swing and bluegrass band, and all of the arrangements, everything was done. All I had to do was show up and sing, which was great. I loved that. I just loved that. The second and third times was with a quartet I was with in California called Tarred and Feathered. And we did it on the cheap, which means the first cassette was a guy who was a sound engineering major at the university, and that was his senior project. And then the second time was, I can't even remember what the circumstances was with our second cassette. And then the third time, my ex-husband and I, who was also a musician, we did an album together, and we did it in a friend's home studio. And I learned a little bit about recording with those, but it really wasn't until I started doing the Long Gray Line in 2000 mm-hmm. that I started going, oh, this is a lot harder than it really is. And I was very fortunate in that the engineer I was working with was able to hold me up a little bit, because I had no other choice but to self-produce. I had been in New England for 2 years at that point, and I knew I needed a producer. Mm. I knew it. I just knew it. But I didn't know enough people at the time, and the person that I did ask to produce told me, he said, well, you already have a studio, and so we can't do it, because I have a studio I like to work with. And if you already have a studio and this guy is going to be the engineer, I can't do it. And that was a real, and it was like, oh, now we have musical politics here. So
that's pretty common in my understanding of how things go. Yeah.
Ugh. Really?
Yeah. If things are recorded one way and the producer doesn't really agree with how it was done, then they will just be annoyed the whole time they're trying to edit it and work
right,
with it.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's and through the, you know, through the years, I've learned all this stuff. I mean, but back then, I mean, I was really, like I said, I was really lucky. This guy who has a studio in Boston offered, he says, I really, really want to record you. And he kept after me, and I had no money. Mm-hmm. And finally he said, I'll give you the studio time at $10 an hour. And I went,
oh, wow.
Duh. So yeah. I went in totally, really, you know, it was really my first time in a very, in a real professional studio.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the tracks and the whole thing, and I call the Long Gray Line "Flying by the Seat of My Pants" record, because that's basically what it was.
Sometimes we do our best learning on the job.
That was definitely on the job, definitely.
And you produced it yourself?
I produced it myself. Yeah.
Wow. Did you get training from that friend who had gone to school for audio production, or did you learn that by the seat of your pants too? Or,
well, that was, you know, that was like 14 years before in California.
Right.
What I did have was, I had the guy who I'd asked to produce, I asked for feedback after we were all done.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in mixing, because I have no idea, and I still have no idea about mixing, you know, mixing tracks and making them sound better and getting them ready mm-hmm. for final whatever, because I don't have those kinds of ears.
Mm-hmm.
And all I knew was, well, just I don't like the way that sounds so closed. Can you open it up, but make it open? Well, what do you mean by open? The engineer would say, and I'd say, just open. I don't know. Open.
Right.
Because right. I didn't have the, I didn't know what about frequencies, or I still don't. So I did the rough mixing with the engineer. We kind of collaborated on what we thought might sound good. And then I took the rough mixes to three people mm-hmm. who I respect. and who had ears and knew what they were doing. And I said, what can I pay you to listen to this and tell me where I need to make improvements? Mm-hmm. And, you know, one guy said, oh, you can just bring me Johnny Cunningham, the late Johnny Cunningham. I said, you can just bring me a bottle of wine. I said, I'll bring you five.
Nice.
So, you know, and that is part of my need to get feedback is I was not about to release my first solo album and having it sound like it was recorded in somebody's basement. You know, I did not want that to happen because this was going to be my first solo solo outing in recording. Right. And it needed to sound as good as I could get it with what I had. So I hired the musicians. I was there every step of the way.
Yeah. Wow.
And I have to say one of the best compliments I've ever got was the engineer I work with now. I gave him a copy of The Long Gray Line. And at one point he said, who mixed this? And I said, I did. And he goes, you did a pretty good job.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
And I went, well, I had help.
So, Heather, you've also recorded.
True.
And that's, how was that different for you than you thought it was going to be when you recorded?
I didn't have any expectations, so I don't know if it was different than I thought it was going to be. It just happened.
That's cool.
Like, recording for me is always, like, growing up, like a punk rock kid, like just you record yourself, yes, in the basement at first, but as you become like a more adult person with better equipment, you move
and
up
with
to
a
your
husband who knows what he's talking about when it comes
who
to
eventually
audio.
Learned what he comes yeah, yeah, yeah. up what he's talking about. But also he learned just from doing it also.
Right.
And you just get better and better each time, and he's been getting better for the better part of 49 years. So he's pretty good. So it's just like a slow learning by doing thing.
Yeah.
And I've always just been recording with people who I know.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of been how it goes. You always have other people listen to it and get feedback and stuff too.
Yeah.
I have only been in the studio once so far, and that was to lend harmonies to a friend's EP. And then I also did one other recording experience that was not in a fancy official recording studio in New York City. And they both taught me a bunch of stuff that I didn't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I did not know until I was in the room on the first recording I ever did, which was the one that was not in an official recording studio, how important music theory was going to be for that particular experience. And I have also learned since then that music theory is going to be important for some of those experiences and less vital for others, depending on whose album it is and how much theory information they have and how much they speak that language. But I proceeded to... After I did the first recording, I proceeded to ask Armand, who we all know and love, to teach me music theory so that the next time I was in a recording situation, if somebody said, I want a four chord here, I wouldn't be the one holding everybody back going, wait, a what? What's happening? Yeah. And so I'm grateful to recording for teaching me music theory, which I have always hated.
To me, the music theory part comes during like the writing part. So it surprises me to hear that, that the theory was still happening by the time you got to the point where you're in the studio.
Well, I guess
to me, that is surprising.
Well, because in this particular case, I was offering harmonies. And so the person whose album it was like, okay, I want it to sound like this. And then Armand was in the room who went, okay, so what that means is you want a four chord. And the person whose album it was like, I trust you. You are the theory person here. Go for it. Because he has a lot of arranging experience. And so then he would say, okay, guys, we want a four chord here. And then I would go, a what now? And he would say, sing this note.
I think maybe the process of recording is different depending on what kind of band it is or group it is or whatever. Because also you left out one time that you did another recording, which was for this band called the Handy Die Waymen.
I did.
Which is
true.
The one song, a version of the band the Dandy Highwaymen that existed for only one song, and you
one
came in and
shining
and sang harmonies on an ABBA cover, a gothy ABBA cover,
and I wore the dress I'm wearing today, and it's still one of my favorite musical experiences.
And that was more the kind of experience that you're describing you had elsewhere too, just like, Kate, hey, sing harmonies, you're good at harmonies, just please do that, go. Which is not everyone can be trusted to just be like, hey, you do that. Come do that for me. It's, so that's why I think that you're having these unusual experiences. People just are like, you sing harmonies nice. Please do it. Thank you. Which I don't think is normal, usually. Normally, like, you have to write the song and know what the song is and then go record the song.
Yeah. That's, yeah. I mean, and that's a really good point because also, you know, that was me coming in and offering some a cappella addition to a thing, which was a totally different style of music from the first recording I did or from the second recording I did, where we had in the second recording we had a drummer and we had the lead singer and we had I think a bassist and a guitarist, I think. And Deb, you've had, I mean, you always record with a band except for those solitary tracks where you just sing a cappella, but mostly you have a band with you too.
Well, yeah. And but it's not, the thing was that after I did Long Gray Line and then I did Dad's Dinner Pail, which was the album that culminated in the research of the Helen Hartness Flanders collection. After those two albums, I said, I've got to have a producer. I cannot do this without a producer. I really, really can't. Because my experiences with those two albums, even though they came out okay, I knew they could be better. And Johnny Cunningham, who, for those of you who don't know, Johnny Cunningham was a Scots fiddler who had moved to the States and lived in New Bedford, but he was one of the founding members, almost founding members of the Scots band Silly Wizard. And Johnny became a very good friend, and I had actually asked him if he would, and he had produced a lot of great albums, and I had asked him if he would produce my second album, because even after Long Gray Line, I knew I needed a producer, because I just did not have the confidence to make something go that would be really, really excellent. And Johnny said, yeah, I think this would be really cool. And we were just starting to talk about it, and he died. So it was like, yeah. And I mean, he very suddenly died in 2003. And that was like, oh, well, okay. Yeah. So that's when Dad's Dinner Pail, I was just starting to do the research, not even thinking about doing an album on Flanders. And so that's when Dad's Dinner Pail came about. And at that point, I was with a record label. And so I went down to Virginia and recorded Dad's Dinner Pail with my friend Michael Dalala. And he and I co-produced it. And we released that in 2005. And then, you know, I always wait a couple of years to do another album or to think about doing another album. And again, I was going, I want a producer. I gotta have a producer. It really depends on the person. And if you think you can do a good job, go for it. You know, I only speak for myself.
Right.
For me, I love having somebody be in charge. Really, in all things, I love having somebody else in charge. Let them, and some people love doing that. That's great. So, by 2006, you know, and you're always thinking about these things, at least I am. So by 2006, I thought, okay, it's probably time to make another record that I can release in a couple of years, you know, so we'll see what happens. And I just so happened to see that an acquaintance of mine down south had released an album. He's a singer-songwriter in North Carolina, and he used Dave Maddox and this other guy, Tom Doobie, who lives in Cambridge, as co-producers. You know, and I knew Dave Maddox was here. I knew he had moved over from the UK. Again, Dave Maddox was the drummer for Fairport Convention, among a bazillion other artists. I mean, he's, you know, the catchphrase is, who hasn't Dave played with? And so I knew Dave was living in the Boston area. In fact, I'd seen him play in 2002 in Cambridge. So, but I didn't know that he was producing. I thought he was just, you know, the go-to drummer for Paul McCartney. So I contacted my friend in North Carolina and I said, tell me about your experience with Tom and Dave. And I said, specifically Dave. And he came back and he said, it was one of the best experiences I ever had. Wow. They were right on the money and the efficiency was amazing. And yeah, you know, because I said, I think I want to ask Dave Maddox to produce my next record. Mm-hmm. So he had a website. There was an email. And for 3 weeks, I bit my fingernails saying, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to cut this guy? I've been listening to this guy since 1970.
Right.
He was with Jethro Tull, my favorite band. He was
But you did it.
Convention, my favorite
but you
band.
Did it.
And I just said, it was kind of like the time I left teaching. And I said, if I don't do this now, I'll never do it. You have got to do this. So I emailed him and I told him I was interested in him producing my next record. You know, it was just like, so-and-so told me that you had co-produced. We have some mutual friends in the UK and, you know, I kind of dropped a couple of names and he got right back to me. Let's meet up and have a chat. And that's how it started.
Wow. Yeah. Do you have advice for other people who are looking to collaborate with people that they look up to?
other than
go for it.
Other than Heather's favorite piece of advice, which is really sterling, which is just do the thing.
You just never know. And and in all things, my go-to thought when I'm debating things is the worst they can say is no.
Right.
What's the worst they can respond? No. And nothing's going to happen. The world is not going to fall apart. And if they say no, you go on to plan B or you go on to the next step. If Dave had said, I can't do this for whatever reasons, I would have gone on to plan B and probably found, you know, just kept asking people.
Yeah.
You know, he said yes. And the thing was, he had a methodical way of starting out. It was brilliant. My advice would be, jump off the cliff, make the phone call, send the email. And if they say no, have a plan B. Make sure you have a plan B and go to plan B. And if plan B falls through, go to plan C.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you'll figure it out.
Yeah, I love that. That's sound advice right there.
Sound advice?
Pun. Nice. I didn't mean to do that. So we have this question that we often like to ask people. It's a bit of a like shifting gears, but can you tell
you
us
again.
What?
Gears.
Okay.
It's the one I thought it was going to be.
Yes. So can you tell us about a system you've created or a tool that you've found that makes your work or your life easier?
Well, the internet.
You know,
it's been a game changer. The Hank Ulrich, I call it the Hank Ulrich trademark method of promotion is you take us. So, you know, Facebook gives you those, you know, only you can see this, trying to get you to pay money to make an ad kind of thing. So you take a screenshot of the preview and then you post it on your, you know, your thing.
That's really brilliant.
And, but I mean, seriously, the internet has been in many, many ways, some positive, some negative, a game changer for us. I asked John McCutcheon once, I said, how did you do this before the internet? And he says $1,000 phone bills.
Wow.
Yeah. And I can remember when I was, you know, playing the bars in Redding, California, making up posters with press on letters, you know, one letter at a time, going to the copy center and making 100 photocopies of your poster with the press on letters.
Wow.
And you take a week and you run around town posting posters all over town and mailing them out. You know, you get the roll of 150 or 200 stamps and you hand address everyone, tri-fold them, throw a stamp on it, put it in the mail.
Right.
And I mean, that was how you promoted your gigs. If you were traveling, John told me that what you would do is you would get the posters and you would have to arrive at the town a day early. And you go all over town putting up the posters.
Right. Yeah, so, I feel like that method of working stayed true through even like 2001 or two or something. Like I still remember running around and putting up posters that I had made photocopies of, even though I was like pretty good with computers and stuff. But if you wanted to actually combine the artwork with the typography and stuff, it was easier to just cut it out and make photocopies at that time.
Well, and I did that with some events that I put together in college. So I did it through 2011 for not music stuff.
So stuff changes quickly. And
I came to New England in 1998 and because I'm married to a technical person and a computer person and a web person, he put up a little website for me.
Love it.
With little MP4 clips, little teeny streaming MP4 clips. And that was in 1998. And so I remember one of the venues that hired me said, you're one of the first people that had a website.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I got my first computer in 1987. So, and who knew you could use it to do stuff like this? I mean, because we didn't have computers in 1981 or 1978. Right. We, you know, nobody had, you know, they're the mainframes at the college. So the internet has been a game changer, but it's also one of the problems with the internet is the noise to signal ratio. I mean,
for sure.
Now you got to cut through everything else.
Right.
For somebody's attention. I was thinking, I heard somebody talking about, I was on somebody was talking about their competition in podcasting. It was a podcaster and he was saying, well, somebody asked me about my competition. And I said, my competition isn't the other podcast. It's the Xbox. It's Netflix. It's, you know, that's my competition. Mm-hmm. And now for music, and especially my demographic, which is elderly. I mean, I'm elderly, so I guess they're my contemporaries, but people can't drive at night. Mm-hmm. So staying, people use the internet to get their music delivery now.
As in they don't go out to clubs anymore?
Right, for various reasons. Although,
and this last year and a half, no one went either.
Yeah, right. I know.
Well, but we had the live streaming for those of us who were able to do it. But interestingly, we also wanted to ask, well, okay, so this is one for both of you. This is one for Deb and Heather together. Sure. Because you're both really, really excellent at promo, internet and beyond. And so I have a couple questions for you guys. One, is there something about the process that makes it easier to stay on top of? And two, are there any must-have materials or reminders to suggest to those of us who struggle with it to just like, is there anything we should absolutely have, any tool we should absolutely use? Is there any thing you have learned that you want to pass on about doing that kind of work?
Well, when you say struggle, Kate, what do you mean?
First of all, for some of us, the confidence situation that comes up, like, you know, I don't want to invite all of the same people to another gig because I don't want them to roll their eyes, or I don't want to post this everywhere because I already posted something everywhere and it feels really arrogant, or like I have so much going on that I don't have a lot of time to do. This is the, I'm not specifically talking about me necessarily, but I have so much going on that I don't necessarily have the time to stay on top of it, or Facebook is making me pay the money and I can't afford it. Like all of the intrinsic and outer pressures around promo and why it is a pain in the butt.
Yeah. Well, Kate has heard this story, but Heather, you have not, and neither of the listeners. So I will tell you a story, a promo story.
Okay, cool.
John Roberts, who I occasionally work with, wonderful singer of traditional songs from the English-speaking world and a dear friend and mentor. John and I did a tour of the UK 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And my goal in bringing him over was he has not lived in the UK for almost 60 years, but my goal was to introduce him to these audiences and let them know that this is one of the people who has brought your music from the UK to American audiences. And it is, we need, you know, he should be recognized for that. Mm-hmm. So, I got, one of the things I did was I put together a little graphic, and that's, and talk about tools, I guess, any kind of program that where you can create graphics, little graphics, and turn them into PDFs and JPEGs is worth their weight in gold. And for me, for myself, I use Apple Pages. I just,
oh, cool. You know,
that just works for me. So I created this little PDF graphic with our pictures. At that point, we didn't even have pictures of us together. I just had these separate headshots. And the tour schedule on the graphic and the dates and all that stuff. And so I sent the graphic over to John to proofread to make sure that I spelled stuff right and what it looked like. So we're on the phone. I'm on the phone with him. And I said, is the graphic okay? And he says, oh, it's fine. It's fine. And he says, you went to a lot of trouble. You didn't have to do that. And I said, John, we want people to come, don't we?
Correct.
And he said, there is that.
There is that.
There is that. So those of us who, like myself, with a dreadful insecurity problem or... you know, feel all of the things that you were describing, Kate, as far as the intrinsic stuff. The thing is that just because you book it doesn't mean people are coming.
Right. And it's on us as part of the agreement to promote it anyway, right?
Well, it's, I look at it as a partnership.
That's my experience.
It's a partnership. Right. And it's a partnership between the venue and the artist.
Right.
If I'm playing a venue in some town where I'm not very well known, I mean, let's say Oklahoma City. Let's say I'm going to Oklahoma City and I'm going to play a concert in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And it's a public concert put on by some folk society or somebody. Nobody, there's four people in Oklahoma City who know who I am. And one of them is family. And one of them is family.
Right.
You know? So it's like, how do we get people to come? Well, you have to tell people. Mm-hmm. You have to let them know. And you have to put all of that stuff aside. And you have to say, I want people to come. Here are the tools you as a venue need from me to get people to come. Mm-hmm. And I have a little promo thing. I have a little thing on my website for venues. It's what your response, what I think your responsibilities are and what my responsibilities are.
Oh,
in promoting the gig. And my responsibilities are, I'm going to put it in my newsletter. It's going to be on my website. I'll throw it on Facebook. You know, now that we have social media, I mean, 10-12 years ago, we didn't have social media.
Right.
I mean, we did, but it wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now.
Right.
And it's a partnership between the artist who has been invited to perform and the venue who is hosting the event.
Right. I appreciate deeply that you not only believe this, but that you put it on your website as like a, hey guys, this is what I expect you to do. And in exchange, this is what I will do because it is a partnership. This is something for you to know before you book me.
And the thing is, for every venue, there are 100 performers who want to play it.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, that's a conservative estimate.
Right.
There might, you know, who knows? And so you have to be like, I want to please the venue so they'll ask me back or that they'll give me a gig. Well, if you don't make things easy for them, they're not going to ask you back and they're not going to give you the gig. When you make people work for stuff, they move on, especially now. I mean, the attention span now of somebody on the internet is like a second.
Right.
I don't know what the research is, but
go ahead.
You know, if you don't have their attention, if they're, and especially a radio DJ, a venue booker, a publicist, you know, a person who writes reviews of your music, if you don't make it easy for them to access that information, you're toast. They're going to move on.
So having like a electronic press kit or like a single page that lays out like, here is my bio. Here's the short version. Here's the long version. Mm-hmm. Here's like the top three portraits you might want to use of us and or some other images of album covers or work if it's visual art or whatever, just all in like one place that they can just go grab it from. I found that places really appreciate. And my bandmate, Chris from the Dirge Carolers, has this great story from before I was in the band where there was short version. There was the Columbine shootings and people were really like down on goth kids at the time. So that all the goth kids were like, hey, we're going to make a fundraiser / show of support for everyone who is in Columbine to show like, actually we really care. And that was super messed up and it's not cool. And it was called, I think, 15 Lilies. And this record company or promoter of some kind reached out to all these different artists and asked for a list of things, kind of like what I just described, like bio photos, send your song in this format. Mm-hmm. And he was maybe the only one who actually followed the directions and gave all the stuff, or at least one of very few. So the Dirge Carolers were like featured super prominently, which was not in line at all at the time with their level of fame and acclaim and whatever. It just has to do with like making it easy for people, like just give the people what they actually asked for once you've gotten their attention.
Follow directions.
Follow directions.
Thing. Yeah, and I have a page on my website. I have the electronic promotional kit, and that is here I am. This is who I am. Book me. You know all the stuff that you might want to know if you're going to try and book if you want to book me, and then there's the promotional tools once the gig is booked. That it's a page on my site, and it's just so easy. Once the gig is secured, I give them a link and they can go to that page and they can download any, they can download anything they want. There's so much there. There's photos, there's bio, there's newspaper articles, there's magazine articles, there's everything. And then I say, if you need something that's not on that page, please let me know.
Right.
And yeah. I think the biggest thing that I emphasize is communication. It is so important that we talk. And we consistently talk, you know, every 2 weeks checking in. Is there anything else from me? How's the promotional going? Then what do I need to do? Is there anything else? You know, it's just in, and so many venues don't do that. It's like, you know, they don't return my emails. I've sent the contract. It's not returned.
Yeah. So I think a lot of what we're talking about is like, once you have successfully captured their attention in some way, like make sure you follow through and follow up and stuff. I also had some thoughts about like getting their attention in the first place in this like sea of, yes, they're going to be scrolling through Facebook or Instagram or what have you, the places that the people hang out, TikTok, and they're just going to scroll on past you. So my best like idea, which fortunately still works, is to make a very strong effort to be there when you are what they're actively looking for. Make sure that they can actually find you. So like, if like, think of what you are actually marketing to people. Is it like English ballad singers of New England or whatever? And make sure like when they Google that, you come up. Is really like Google, like search engine optimization and like having your Google Maps and Yelp listings and whatever relevant listings there are for the kind of performer that you are, and just be on everything. So when people are looking, you're there to be found. Because
there's also an energy quotient there too. I mean, I've really tried to, I have enough energy for 3 social media platforms.
I really have energy for 0, so just my website.
By the way, have a website, guys.
Right.
Do it. Have a website, because first of all, it took me a while to feel like I was legit enough to have one. Put that aside, because you are harming yourself professionally if all you have is social media presence on sites where you don't own your stuff.
Yeah.
Heather, I know you have feelings
about
this. I've
said this so many
times.
But
like, I'm just right. Yeah. Let's just back up Heather's previously mentioned in other episodes thing, and also in life thing, about
own
life.
Own your stuff.
Own your stuff. Have your own website. Because also, if you have your own website, you control all the everything. And it's a really helpful space to be like, okay, now I can collect all the information about what other channels actually worked for me, or didn't they?
Right.
Put all your energy in something you have control over.
Mm-hmm. Right. The website is your billboard.
Yes,
it's your billboard on the internet. It's the billboard that is right in the middle of I-95.
Yeah,
you know it. I mean, it really is. And but I would also caution, if you're serious about what you're doing as a creator, make sure your website looks good, and make sure you have somebody. If I take this attitude not only in my work, but in my home, you know, I am incompetent when it comes to plumbing or anything like that. Construction, forget it. I hire people. And I'm lucky I can afford to hire people. My husband and I can afford to hire people, because then we know the job is done right. And in my work, if I can, I will hire people, because then I know the job will be done right. The worst thing in the world is to do something and then have to tear it down and do it all over again. Because that's when you come into more expense, you know. And my engineer tells me about how many times people come to him with their recording they did in their basement and they need lots of stuff fixed that they can't fix. And so they take it to him, because
better
they know
do it right the first time. Yeah, or hire people if you can't.
Right. Hire somebody with 49 years experience.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, man.
So there are two final things. We were wondering, how and where can our listeners best find out about your gigs and your albums and work?
At my website. Yay!
Yay! Oh, that's a nice right. segue.
Yes.
Deborah Cowan, DeborahCowan.com. And one of the best ways really is to sign up for my email newsletter. And then I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I am on TikTok, but I just haven't really figured it out yet. All of those are Deborah Cowan Music.
Excellent.
Branding.
Love it. Consistent cool. branding is important.
Yeah, except YouTube, because I don't have 100 subscribers yet. So until I get 100 subscribers.
We can help. What yes. is it currently? Because I
right
mean,
now it's
every
it's
person listening, you might get 12 more.
it's right now at DCowan56. That's my handle on YouTube. But once I get, I think it's 100 subscribers. I think when you get 100 subscribers, you can customize your URL.
Right. So, yeah.
And I only need like 20 more.
Well, oh, great. There you go. Maybe this will help get you there.
I hope so.
Great. Cool.
Awesome. Awesome. So we have one more question for you, which is our favorite thing to ask everybody. Tell us one of your favorite things about singing for a living.
The people.
Mm.
The people. I was fortunate in last month, I got to do 2 live music performances.
Yay.
And to be in front of people who were not in little boxes on a screen was the most enjoyable thing ever.
Yeah.
It really brings back the joy of what I do.
Welcome back.
In singing for and with people, because part of my deal, as Kate knows, is joining in. I love it when people sing along. And it's the people. And it's not only the audience, but I have always said that with folk music, and I don't know about other genres, but, you know, because folk music is really the only genre that I've been involved with, people are so wonderful. They're so generous. They're so kind. And when I'm on the road, I get treated so well. People open up their homes to us. They cook for us. Some people do our laundry. And the folk music community all over the world has got to be one of the most giving and generous communities I've ever encountered.
Absolutely.
It's really special. And so that's what it is. It's the people.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
I get to meet so many amazing people. And it's the other thing too is, you know, I spent my early adulthood listening to all kinds of musicians. And as I got a little older, from adolescence, I started listening to people like John Roberts and Tony Barron and Louise Akillin and David Jones and Matty Pryor and Jackie McShee and the late Sandy Denny. And the thing that is amazing to me is some of those people have now become dear friends. And so they're not only mentors, but they're people who I consider very good friends. And that's been amazing to me. I always just go, wow.
And now I feel like you are that to Kate.
True.
So it continues.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Absolutely. 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 Absolutely.
Live podcast is produced by Heather Kaunt-Nolton and Kate Clifford. You can find us at makinglifepodcast.com. And our music, as always, is brought to you by November Party.